Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Adam Gitlin, counsel with the Brennan Center for Justice Democracy Program, who discusses the impact new voter suppression laws in 17 states could have on the 2016 presidential and congressional election. Mohammed Hafez, a Syrian-born architect, who explains how he expresses his anguish about the bloody conflict that has engulfed his country through art. And independent journalist Jesse Meyerson, who assesses the discussions now underway to transform Bernie Sanders' presidential campaign into an enduring progressive movement. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
In early March, Honduran indigenous environmental activist Berta Cáceres was assassinated by a masked man who broke into her home. 2 weeks later, her colleague, Nelson Garcia, was killed, putting pressure on the Obama White House to pursue justice for dozens of murdered activists, journalists, and labor leaders in Honduras since a 2009 coup. 4 men linked to Cáceres' murder were arrested by Honduran police on May the 2nd, but Cáceres' family members have asked for an independent investigation by the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights, a demand rejected by the government. The Obama administration supports Honduran President Juan Orlando Hernandez, even as some U.S. officials suspect state or state-supported assassins killed the activists. The administration's plan to expand an aid package of $750 million to Honduras, El Salvador, and Guatemala has run into resistance in Congress. 60 lawmakers have signed a letter calling for a partial suspension of aid to Honduras, pending a review of Cáceres' killing and an independent investigation stating, "We are appalled by our government's continuous assistance to the Honduras security services, so widely documented as corrupt and dangerous." Activists see the case as a litmus test for how the Obama administration treats human rights in Honduras. The New River, China's last wild river, winds through a remote area of southwestern China near the border with Myanmar. It is now the scene of a fierce battle between a state-owned electric company and environmentalists. For the time being, it appears green activists are winning the day, as many in China see the area as a future magnet for tourism. In 2013, the Chinese government authorized a state-owned hydropower company to draw up plans for a series of dams on the New River, one of the poorest areas in the country. Yet the power company had not filed any environmental impact statements as required by law in an area designated by UNESCO as a World Heritage Site. Hu Chaogang, head of the group Green Watershed, told the Christian Science Monitor, "The dam proposal will destroy the river ecology and harm local farmers and fishermen." Opponents of the dam project, which would displace some 17,000 indigenous ethnic minorities, are somewhat optimistic given that there's now less demand for electricity and the government has been more sensitive to environmental issues with recent efforts to curb air pollution and carbon emissions. In high school, Baltimore resident Destiny Watford raised local concern about the health impact of a proposed massive waste-to-energy incinerator slated for her Curtis Bay neighborhood. The plant would have emitted over 1,000 pounds of lead into the air annually. Watford co-founded the activist group Free Your Voice, which organized opponents to attend public meetings and pressured Baltimore public schools and other institutions to drop their support for the incinerator project, despite strong backing from former Maryland Governor Martin O'Malley. In April, Watford won the prestigious Goldman Prize for her grassroots environmental activism, the third youngest person to ever receive the international award. According to a 2013 MIT study, Baltimore has the highest rate of emissions-related deaths of any big city in the United States. Many of the deaths were in Watford's Baltimore neighborhood of Curtis Bay, which is home to the nation's largest medical waste incinerator. In March, the Maryland Department of the Environment pulled the permit. Now Watford and other activists are pushing to develop alternative projects for the site, such as a solar farm or a recycling facility. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Nigel Victor Rees.
Since the 2010 midterm election, 22 states, most of them controlled by the Republican Party, have passed an assortment of new laws that make it more difficult for specific groups of citizens to vote. 17 states will have new voting restriction laws in place for the first time in a presidential election in November 2016. These measures include restrictive voter ID laws, reduction in the days and hours of early voting, and obstacles placed on registering new voters and accessing absentee ballots. New voter suppression laws in these states were made possible in large part by the Supreme Court's 2013 ruling, which gutted a key section of the Voting Rights Act of 1965. While GOP lawmakers assert new limits on voting rights have been introduced to prevent voter fraud, independent analysis has found no evidence to support their claim. A recent study conducted by the University of California at San Diego on the effect new restrictive voter IDs have had on voting patterns found that these new measures disproportionately affect minority voters that largely support Democratic Party candidates. In fact, accusations by civil liberties groups and other political observers that the new voting restrictions are motivated by the pursuit of partisan political advantage have been confirmed by some Republican Party officials themselves. Todd Albaugh resigned as chief of staff to a leading Wisconsin Republican state senator when he found that new voter ID laws in his state were put in place to reduce the votes of minorities and college students. Former South Carolina senator and current president of the Conservative Heritage Foundation recently admitted that new voter restrictions help conservative candidates by blocking Democratic voters. Your reporter spoke with Adam Gitlin, counsel with the Brennan Center for Justice Democracy Program, who discusses the impact new voter suppression laws in 17 states could have on the 2016 presidential and congressional election.
There are two kinds of restrictions we are seeing, one could say. There are restrictions that have to do with imposing new requirements on voters, like photo ID laws. These are laws that require voters to, even if they're already registered, to show a certain form of ID or one of a few forms of ID before being permitted to vote. And in some states, like Texas, they have restricted heavily the range of IDs that one can show, often without necessarily one seeing a clear connection between the different kinds of ID that one is allowed to show. So, for instance, in Texas, you can use a license to bear a firearm, but you can't use a student ID. And so some of these restrictions seem targeted at trying to make it harder for certain populations to vote, but not others. And then there are the other kinds of restrictions that are rollbacks of earlier expansions of the right to vote, like reducing the number of early voting days, that is, days before Election Day in which you can cast a ballot, eliminating same-day registration, so eliminating the ability to register and cast a ballot on the same day, and other similar expansions of the right to vote that have been rolled back since the Shelby County decision.
There's a lot of concern about the impact of these new voting restrictions on the numbers of people who can vote on Election Day, and also the disproportionate impact, particularly on minorities, young voters, and low-income voters. Review for our listeners a bit about what we do know in terms of the research when it comes to the impact on individual voters and the larger issue of the potential changing of outcomes of victors and losers in elections.
It's important to note at the outset that it's going to take years to fully quantify the impact of voter ID laws, but there is growing evidence of damage. There are studies that have shown a decrease in turnout. Probably the most well-known of these is the nonpartisan U.S. Government Accountability Office released a study that found that turnout among eligible and registered voters declined on the order of 2 to 3% in 2012 in Kansas and Tennessee, both of which have a photo ID requirement. There's a more recent study from some folks at the University of California in San Diego that looked at the minority white turnout gap in strict photo ID law states and states that didn't have strict photo ID laws, and they also found drops in turnout for certain minority groups in states that had stricter photo ID laws. Certainly, there has been some research done on the fact that in oftentimes some of the most politically competitive states, it may be more possible with the right tide to pass a voter ID law, because there is some belief that voters of certain political persuasions may be the ones more likely to be affected by these voter ID laws.
Adam, if you could briefly speak to the status of challenges, court challenges, federal court challenges, Supreme Court challenges to some of these laws. Have they been all exhausted here, or what's left on the table in terms of voting rights advocates and what they can do to stop some of these laws?
So a number of these laws are being challenged in a variety of settings. I would say some have more of a public image. There's more recognition that they are likely to be addressed eventually by the Supreme Court than others. Some are simply likelier to move than others. I would say probably the two most notable ones are challenges to North Carolina's voter ID law and challenges to Texas's voter ID law. Both of those are still alive. Last week, as you probably know, in North Carolina, a federal district court judge ruled against the plaintiffs there, but the plaintiffs have already appealed. And in Texas, the law has already been stricken down by three federal courts, but now the full Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals is going to be hearing a challenge to the law, and it's anyone's guess what happens after that, but it is reasonably likely that whoever loses will appeal to the United States Supreme Court.
That was Adam Gitlin, counsel with the Brennan Center for Justice Democracy Program. Learn more about the status of challenges to voter suppression laws across the U.S. by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. The war in Syria has entered its sixth year, and despite a partial ceasefire in place for a few months that somewhat reduced the daily number of fatalities and injuries, in late April, attacks by both the Assad government and some rebel groups in the city of Aleppo caused the deaths of more than 200 Syrians. The United Nations and humanitarian groups have estimated that more than 300,000 Syrians have been killed in the war thus far, with more than 11 million refugees and internally displaced persons since 2011, more than half of the country's pre-war population. Mohammed Hafez, born in Damascus, Syria, and educated in the U.S., earned his degree in architecture and is now working for an architectural firm in New Haven, Connecticut. In recent years, he has turned to making art, informed by his architect's training, to create images and sounds of Syria both before the war and after the terrible destruction, loss of life, and dislocation caused by the conflict. Hafez has exhibited his work and spoken to audiences about his art and the war across the Northeast U.S. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Hafez about what motivates his art and his hopes for the future of his war-torn country. As an immigrant to the U.S., he declined to discuss the specific military situation in Syria, but did express his views about the need for more assistance to refugees and international humanitarian aid.
I think my architecture career does influence the art career tremendously. That's primarily because I am interested in the human interaction with architecture. I come from Damascus, which is the oldest city, continually inhabited city in the world. And there are layers upon layers upon layers of human trace on architecture when you walk these old Damascus alleyways and roads. And in that sense, we have the ability to write our history sort of on the architectural scape. There's this ability for architecture to become a medium to tell a story, right? So I use that in telling stories about my beloved Syria in hopes that you tell enough to humanize the conflict so that somebody can relate to these personal stories and day-to-day activities. So that's what I focus on by making miniature work that is highly detailed, yet, you know, politically charged.
You said you spent 8 years in the U.S. before being able to return to Syria in 2011, which was the year the war started, but I understand the war had not yet come to the part of Damascus where you were. What was it like for you?
And that was such a breather because I was so homesick and I was so longing to my beautiful city and country that I started walking around cities and recording people's conversations. I would sit in the courtyard of the Umayyad Mosque and record children playing in the courtyard and record different merchants talking and different calls to prayers off of each of the surrounding mosques. And of course, as we know today, this is a moment of peace that is no longer existent. And I stumbled across these recordings by mistake four years later, when I was starting to make political artwork. So these stories are merely, you know, I infuse these sound recordings into these realistic models that reconstruct the destruction of Syria, so to speak. And when you add the sound and the life that was there before the war to the pieces, sort of really add a fourth dimension to the piece, a consciousness. My goal is to document the normal day-to-day activities. People look at me crazy, like, what are you doing? But I went around and recorded normal conversations, recording my friends playing cards together at a cafe shop, and, you know, yelling at each other and having a good time, not knowing that 5 years later, that each one of them would be living in a different country. Some of them have become residents of other countries in the Gulf region, and some of them have actually become refugees.
Mohammed Hafez, what can you say about the forces fighting in Syria with support from both Russia and the U.S.?
Well, I'm not so sure that there is a distinct Syrian hand anymore. It is so many foreign hands in this kitchen. And I'm not interested in the dirty political game. We're so desensitized to what needs to be done. And when it comes to nations that are meaningfully prepared to stop such atrocities, we don't see much being done.
Would you like to see the U.S. do more in Syria and accept more refugees here?
Yes, of course. Absolutely. This great nation is a defender of liberties and human rights with a decades-long record. I am surprised with the little that has been done to aid the humanitarian efforts in Syria. I don't think there's a household in Syria that hasn't lost somebody, that hasn't paid for somebody in prison, or has somebody as a refugee somewhere. I have an immediate family member as a refugee. And that what drove me to do more and more and more work. The more negative sentiment that I hear on the media against refugees, the more I take it upon myself to educate people around me about who refugees are and what is so devastating on the ground there that is, you know, pressuring a father to put his two-year-old in a float across the Mediterranean.
That was Syrian-born artist and architect Mohammed Hafez. Learn more about his art and views on his country's bloody civil war by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. With the current delegate count favoring Hillary Clinton to win the Democratic Party nomination, many disappointed supporters of Bernie Sanders' presidential campaign are now focusing on a larger goal. Activists who have dedicated the last year to winning primary elections for the Vermont senator are now discussing the potential of transforming their unexpectedly strong campaign into an enduring progressive movement. There are different ideas being floated, but most involve gathering the coalition of left activists that supported Sanders and harnessing the power of the campaign's massive donor network and grassroots organizing operation to promote a progressive agenda at the local and national level. An important meeting is now being planned for late June, after the last primary, and before the Democratic National Convention in July. That meeting, dubbed a National People's Assembly, will take place in Chicago and will draw leaders from the National Nurses United Union, People for Bernie, and groups fighting for a $15 minimum wage, the climate change movement, labor unions, and Black Lives Matter organizations. While Senator Sanders has not directly endorsed the idea of forming a new post-election organization, his wife Jane has affirmed that whether her husband wins or loses the nomination, she says the most important thing is starting a political revolution. Your reporter spoke with independent journalist and co-host of the Disorderly Conduct podcast, Jesse Meyerson, who assesses the effort now underway to transform Bernie Sanders' campaign into a lasting progressive movement.
The Sanders campaign is the one political campaign that actually has anything like a coherent theory of change. In every stump speech, Sanders says, no president, not Bernie Sanders or anyone else, can possibly achieve things like single payer without a political revolution, which is to say without millions of people coming together and having sustained prolonged agitation for these things. But it takes a movement that we're up actually against an extremely popular financial and political and media elite who have to be overcome if we're going to get things like free college, universal health care, guaranteed dignified conditions for all people. And to that end, the famous hashtag is Feel the Burn, but the hashtag that's used by Sanders supporters more frequently is not him, us, or not me, us, which is in such stark contrast to the Clinton hashtag, I'm with her. I'm with her really makes it about the candidates. Not him, not me, us really makes it about the movement. And so I think from the beginning, the Sanders campaign has actively fostered the idea that it's not so much about the victory of Bernie Sanders. It's about the movement, the political revolution, as he calls it, to great derision from the establishment press. So I think that's kind of baked into it. And actually, I don't think that the problem is specific to if he loses the nomination. I think the problem would remain even if he became the president. I think it would actually only intensify the necessity for sustained, ongoing radical organizing for these things and pressure put on the political system to achieve these things. So I think that's on the minds of a lot of people. Definitely a lot of supporters are having similar kinds of conversations, what to do beyond Bernie, what the political revolution would look like absent the candidate. And I know that there are meetings happening all over the place. I co-hosted a meeting in Brooklyn at a place called Mayday Space about this question and what people are hoping to achieve afterwards. And it seems like people are definitely in, although not analytically, the same place about what exactly would be the right thing to do. I think that at least attitudinally, everyone understands that this isn't a movement that ends here, that actually it has to continue. And that gives me a great deal of hope.
Jesse, a lot of people have been drawn to Bernie Sanders' campaign for a diversity of reasons. But if this campaign were to be transformed into something more permanent, in as far as a progressive movement goes, what do you think the common denominator would be that would draw these people into a longer-term involvement?
That's a wonderful question. I wish I had a really good answer for it. I mean, the sort of scene that I'm more embedded in rather than in the sort of the electoral sphere is in the social movement sphere. So the activists who I really talk to and have been trying to build with over the last few years are from the movement for Black Lives, the climate justice movement, the low-wage workers movement, Occupy, the immigration rights movement, Dreamers, and so forth. If we're going to take these social movements and maximize their political efficacy, what is that kind of minimum source of alignment that we would need to have in order to do it? And it's very difficult because the sort of systematic destruction of the left in the United States and our institutions and our political education, so that in a sense we have to kind of rebuild and relearn knowledge that we've lost over these many years of sort of Thatcherite, Reaganite, there is no alternativism. And so the question for me about the Sanders campaign isn't how it itself can be sustained, but what pieces of movement infrastructure will emerge from it, for instance, the fundraising tools, the phone banking tools, all of the various innovations that the campaign has brought to the electoral sphere, how those will survive and how they will interact with the movement infrastructure that's been built by previous movement moments. And I just think that each time we have a movement moment, we land on higher ground and higher ground, and eventually, ideally, the ground will be so high that we'll have, not to be too ambitious about it, but, you know, captured political power and implemented a program that is in the universal general interest and not in the interest just of the ownership class.
I've been reading about a summit meeting that's going to be scheduled sometime after the last Democratic Party primary to determine what the future might be for the Sanders campaign, whether he wins the nomination or not. Is your feeling that this is where the action is, this kind of summit meeting, or is this just part of a whole host of organizing that's going on around the country, a lot of it below the radar?
Yeah, I think both things are true. I think that that's going to be a very useful place to bring people together and to discuss what's going on. I noticed that recently they put out a call for proposals for speeches and panels and whatnot. But as you say, it's not the action, it's one action. And there are many other places where the Sanders message and the people who've been brought together by the Sanders campaign can conspire for a much more like locally tailored, you know, responsive to immediate circumstance kind of mode that can let, as they say, a thousand flowers bloom, so that we're not fixated on a single strategy, but that we're nimble enough that we can find different strategies to approach different issues and yet be united by a common set of values or principles or an ethos.
That was independent journalist and co-host of the Disorderly Conduct podcast, Jesse Meyerson. Find a link to Meyerson's recent article titled Building a Movement from Occupy Wall Street to Bernie Sanders and related information by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and support our show, which is celebrating 25 years on the air in 2016. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Nigel Victor Reese, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.